in that remote, unexplored last frontier on Earth. Unchanged since prehistoric times. The land unknown.
Hello, you're listening to the Lost Valley podcast. My name is Kian, and you're very welcome to the Explorers Club. We're in the lounge tonight, where the upholstery is better, the seats are comfier, and the drinks are just a little bit spicier. So why not mix yourself something and take a seat, have a look at the maps and images from strange places around the world. Because the Lost World podcast is, of course, the podcast all about lost worlds in lore and literature. This episode, I'm speaking with Michael Robinson about his book, The Lost White Tribe, one which was very influential on me and which I've read several times. So this is a real pleasure to speak with Michael about the book. Now, getting started, I'll say, as always, you can say hi over at Lost Valley Podcast on Instagram or on Mastodon, where I am still at Wide Atlantic Weird for historical reasons. And if you'd like to send some coffee my way over at buymeacoffee.com/Lost Valley, you can do that as well. Things I've been watching or reading in the last week, I've got my hands on a copy of a book I liked when I was a kid, and it's a version of King Kong. We're going to be talking about King Kong in the near future. I've been reading and watching it, much to do with that early seminal film. But I'm going to come at it kind of sideways from a few kind of topics associated with Kong. We'll be dealing with some maybe Kong-adjacent material in the near future. So I got a hold of a book called Anthony Brown's King Kong. This is a children's book, a children's version of the story of King Kong. But Anthony Brown is an incredible illustrator, and this book is really stirring, really beautiful. And there's a kind of a melancholy, can't speak this evening, there's a melancholy to it. And Kong has always sat in my imagination as a story that has a tremendous amount of, you know, it's got that fairy tale quality in the dialogue, which of course comes from the writing of Ruth Rose on the script, alongside, of course, Ernest Schoedsack and Marion C. Cooper and the various others who contributed to the script, all of which we'll get into someday. But I realise now, you know, some of the sort of, there's a kind of inevitability to the story of Kong. Rewatching it, it's like, we are watching a story that we've heard before, but something dramatic in the foreshadowing of the story, like you're watching some classic tale play out, like it had to be this way, as tragic as it is. And now I'm realizing that, you know, some of that is absolutely in the 1933 film, but I think a lot of that vibe that I had picked up might come from this book, which I did have as a kid. There's constantly these little nods towards what's going to happen, bringing this kind of grim inevitability of tragedy to the story. So yeah, absolutely worth your while tracking down Anthony Brown's King Kong if you're a King Kong person. There's something really, really deep and kind of moving about this interpretation of the story. So it's always nice finding something from your childhood and having it measure up to how you remember it. Okay, in other news, our Dino Synth album for this episode is called Slow and Heavy by the artist known as Diplodocus, or Diplodocus, as I always said as a kid, and I find it difficult to get out of my head now. Maybe it depends on where in the world you're coming from, but this is probably the first, if it's not the first Dino Synth album, it's a bit of a trope namer. There's a kind of a primal quality to this in more than one way. It plowed a new furrow in the ground, kind of established a new subset, a new subgenre of dungeon synth. So this is the kind of Dino Synth that makes you feel like you're in a 1950s movie with stop motion animated dinosaurs, or even guys in terrible suits. As long as they're big and slow and clunky, those are the kind of dinosaurs, and that's the kind of prehistoric lost world conjured up by the album Slow and Heavy. And I'll give a special nod to the track Grazing Antarctopelta. And if you're not familiar with that, Antarctopelta was a Cretaceous ankylosaur species. Okay, So I think that's everything I want to say before we get to the interview. You'll hear me speaking with Michael Robinson about his book, The Lost White Tribe, and I hope you enjoy it.
This is Michael Robinson. I'm the author of The Lost White Tribe, Explorers, Scientists, and the Theory That Changed a Continent.
I think some listeners might know you from your podcast as well. Would you like to say a word about that?
Oh, sure. I have a podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs, which is focused on history, science, and exploration. I haven't put up too many episodes in the last couple of years because I became chair of my department. So it's cut back on my ability to podcast, but I actually have some things in the pipeline. So I look to be uploading some new episodes in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that in the notes. And I think listeners of this show will enjoy that as well. You cover a lot of stuff from the age of exploration, which we like here. And you even had some cryptozoology not so long ago about the Russian Almaty and that sort of thing. So, definitely some crossover there. Anyway, I've asked you to come on to talk about this book, which is it 2016?
That's
the
right.
Lost White Tribe. Mm-hmm. And so I know that's a little while ago, but this is a change of direction for me and my show, and I'm trying to set the table a little bit and try and hit on some themes that I think are going to go, throughout this new iteration of the show. I'm going to be focusing on the idea of lost worlds and lost races in fiction, in lore and literature. That's what I'm thinking of. And this might end up being the first or one of the first episodes of the new direction. And this is a book I've read a couple of times because it did have a big influence on my thinking. And there's lots of things in this book, but I don't know if would you give us an overview of the concept and what's in it?
Yeah, probably the easiest way to talk about it is maybe to talk about how I came to find it as a subject. I was working on my dissertation in the history of exploration. It's basically writing a project on American Arctic exploration in the 1800s and the early 1900s. And it was really a kind of a cultural history of exploration. It was less focused on the expeditions in the field and more interested in why did these expeditions matter so much to people back in the United States. So I was about two-thirds of the way done researching and writing that project when I started finding reports. There was one report in particular of an explorer, an anthropologist and explorer, Vilmar Stefansson, a Canadian-Norwegian explorer and anthropologist who had traveled to the northern edges of the North American continent and up in Banks Island, which is part of that big archipelago above Canada in the Arctic waters there, had come back to Seattle reporting that he had found blonde Eskimos. And that struck me as absurd at the time, but kind of fascinating. And so I started looking at the reception of this idea in the press, and people just went crazy with it. I mean, there were all kinds of people who wrote about who are these people? You know, is this a fraud? If it's true, are they the lost members of the Franklin expedition that maybe intermarried with local Inuit communities, or is it the lost colony of Greenland? I mean, there were just a million different theories. So but there was really no place for it in that project, but it was just so weird and interesting. I kind of tucked it aside. And then after I finished that first dissertation, which became my first book, I kind of came back to it. And over the years, I had found other reports of people finding so-called white people in places that you wouldn't presume they would be, in the heart of Panama, in the center of Central Africa, in the Himalayas, in northern Japan, in the Philippines and New Zealand. I mean, it was all kind of focused around a certain fairly short period of time from about the 1870s through the 1930s. So this project, The Lost White Tribe, was really trying to answer the question, why do these reports start appearing in this period of time? And what were what were explorers actually seeing? What, if anything, can it tell us about the state of culture, but the state of science during that period of time too?
Yeah, absolutely. And that story about the, you know, mystery white Inuit, I think that's where I first came across this book. Edward Guimont, friend of mine, I believe, you know. I learned about that story from him, and I had to track down the book because first, you know, I heard that story about Stephenson meeting these people.
Yes, yeah.
And that was, you know, without context, that seems so weird. Yeah. I also wanted to learn, like, was this story standing alone? Were there other reports of this? And why, you know, you have a wonderful section of the book called A World Gone White, which is when that whole idea takes off and people start reporting people like this all over the place. And it's very clear that, like, something, we'll get into this, but something deep is being addressed here, potentially. You open the book with the story of Henry Morton Stanley, but it's one that you explained the book was well known in his day, and this was quite famous at the time, but is almost forgotten now. And there's how many books about Henry Morton Stanley out there?
I know, there's, dozens. And
they never mentioned this.
Yeah, so Stanley, I mean, I think still, even to this day, although I think Stanley was far more famous maybe 30 or 40 years ago, but still a well-known figure, probably for the famous apocryphal, you know, line that he had when he found David Livingstone in Africa. He said, you know, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. But Stanley was originally a journalist for the New York Herald, which at the time was the biggest, I believe it was the biggest circulation newspaper in the late 1800s in the United States. And he had proposed to his boss, James Gordon Bennett, the publisher, an idea to find a British missionary, David Livingstone, who had been in Africa for many years and who had not reported out from Southern Africa for quite a while. You know, Bennett was all over this idea, funded Stanley to go find David Livingstone in the Lakes region of really kind of East Africa, South Africa region, which he did in the 1860s. And he found Livingstone, and that story and his dispatches from Africa made him a world celebrity. And in a way, where I pick up the story of David Livingstone or Henry Morton Stanley is on his subsequent expedition. He led an expedition in 1874, and you know, from a newspaper point of view, I think Henry Morton Stanley was very eager to maintain this level of fame as well as the New York Herald. They had done such a great job with the first expedition that this expedition would be to essentially confirm some of the reports from other explorers, British explorers, about the source of the Nile in East Africa. There had been a debate for a number of years between two British explorers about whether the source of the Nile was Lake Victoria or one of the other great lakes in the region, such as Lake Tanganyika. And so Stanley would travel to the Lakes region of East Africa and determine, confirm one way or another what it was, the source of the Nile, this long, you know, centuries long geographical mystery. So it was on this expedition to travel through the Lakes region that he goes to Lake Victoria. There's a kingdom there, a kingdom of Buganda led by a king, King Mutesa. And Mutesa hears Stanley's project, and for a variety of reasons, basically allows Stanley to travel through the kingdom and even gives Stanley an escort of 2,000 of his own soldiers, because at this time there were neighboring kingdoms that were also quite unfriendly to Buganda. So Stanley is traveling through the Lakes region and with this large retinue of African soldiers, and he notices that some of them, a small number of them, four of them actually, look quite light skinned. And he finds this kind of striking. He asks one of the officers of this African officers from of this corps, who are they? And he says, oh, these are men from further west in this region called Gambaragara. There's a mountain, great ice-capped mountain out there, and they live on the slopes of this mountain. And so Stanley's kind of fascinated with this story. He writes dispatches back home, calling them, you know, the white race of Gambaragara. He describes them as being almost like Greeks in white shirts in terms of their complexion. And as they're traveling west, he gets close to this area, in fact, sees snow-capped mountains in the west, but is not able to actually reach or ascend the mountains to confirm the reports. And so he goes home, he writes about this in his narrative. It becomes a big story in other newspapers. It's discussed by the scientific community. There are other explorers that deliberate going to Gambaragara to try to find this white tribe. So there's a lot of activity around it. Stanley starts writing more about race. I mean, he really is quite interested in geography, but by the time he gets home, he's really interested in anthropology. And yet, even though Stanley becomes this hugely, spectacularly famous person, both beloved and derided for the violence that he brought to African communities, this story, this piece of it, his discovery or so-called discovery of a white tribe, has just been completely, you know, forgotten. And that's really where my story begins. It's like, what was this all about? And why was it kind of written out of the Stanley biography?
Yeah, I think I read, Explorers on the Nile, Jim Gill's book a few years ago. It's one of many, you know, occasional attempts to overturn Stanley's relationship or Stanley's reputation and change the record on that. You get these reversals of opinion every once in a while. But yeah, nothing about this in that book or any others I had read before. So it was a sensation at the time, and now it's forgotten. Did it mean something to the Victorians that it doesn't to us?
Absolutely. In fact, I think you could say that Stanley did a lot to bring this idea of a lost colony or a lost white race to kind of Victorian attention, but it was certainly maintained and promoted by other people as well, by scientists, by linguists, by physical anthropologists who are studying fossils, by people who are interested in biblical exegesis, by novelists and adventure writers. And ultimately, even in the 20th century, by population biologists. There were so many different groups of people who not just knew about this idea, but accepted it as true. And it had real world ramifications, you know.
So I guess maybe the reason why this idea resonated with me was, and why I was so fascinated to find, like, you know, an origin point for it, perhaps, was that I probably had unconsciously imbibed this over years and years of reading adventure fiction, old-fashioned, you know, stuff from the Victorians right up until the pulps of the 20s and 30s. And again and again and again, you get this repetition of the idea that the European explorers go somewhere exotic and they find the lost civilization. And I don't know, 9 times out of 10, the lost civilization is from some European origin.
Yeah,
there used to be a website. There was an American writer named Jessica Amanda Salmonson who used to maintain this wonderful website. I think she sold books. I think she had a bookshop in like San Francisco or something. But she maintained this database. It seems to be gone now, of lost race fiction. And, you know, she was obsessed with this, and she would chronicle hundreds and hundreds of these really obscure novels. And she would, you know, the index would just tell you when the book was written and what the source of the lost race was. And so with some I would say the biggest outliers on this one, or the most common example that doesn't fit the trope, is that there would be lost Incas or Aztecs or,
yeah,
you know, South American groups of people. But I'd say about 75% of them were lost Greek colonies, Roman colonies, you know, or Hittite sea people, what have you, lost Celtic peoples, you know, lost Welsh peoples, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And even I got annoyed at this as a younger person when I was reading like Edgar Rice Burroughs, which is in space, John Carter's on Mars. But obviously the roots of the planet and sword or whatever it's called is sword and sorcery stuff. It's an updating of fantasy tropes. And even in those books, which are, you know, there's no reason to hew to earthly conventions, you would think, he still discovers at one point that there's an ancient decadent civilization on Mars, and he, you know, it's populated by the red people, I think. And he sees murals on the walls, which show that all of the grand architecture was originally built by some pale race. And I remember being exasperated and saying, even in space, we can't let go of this. So what was going on? Why was it so, you know, I can kind of understand in a colonial context, you know, you might, the usual explanation is that, you know, it's Europeans saying, well, if white people were in some of these places before, then that kind of helps to justify us being there. That's the obvious post-colonial take. But I don't know, why was this, like, it's so rampant for so long, and then it's now out of favor.
Yeah, I mean, hard to get inside the head of a Victorian reader, and probably, you know, of this popular, as you know, is incredibly popular. I mean, it was so widespread. So I think we have to be a little careful to when we talk about motivations or interests, but I'll give it a shot. I think that we do know that the late 19th century is a period of really intense racial thinking about the world, about this is the dawn of race science, when people's explanations about not just about how people look, but how they behave is anchored to an idea of race, and increasingly a genetic idea of race. So I think that's in the air among Western audiences, particularly Anglo-American audiences. And yet, along with these ideas of race and racial hierarchies, which are becoming so strong, there is also well documented in the Western world an uneasiness with the lifestyle of white populations of North America and Europe, that there's an idea that somehow, although the white races of Europe and North America have done so well and are so dominant, that they're also becoming decadent. I think you even use the term decadent in the works of John Carter. And we see this through all kinds of ways, through the rise of the writings of psychologists, or the, you know, the arts and crafts movement, or the emergence of the Boy Scouts, where oftentimes cultural critics are saying we need to connect ourselves more to nature because we're the white race is losing its mojo. And I think when you combine those two things together, this idea that white people, this belief that the white race is superior, but simultaneously that culture is beginning to erode at white character, then you start to see maybe some of the fascination with the idea of, oh, well, what would happen if you took people who were genetically or racially white and put them in an environment where they were detached from all of these cultural, impurities, cultural problems, and what would they do then? And so I think a lot of this adventure fiction is, without being explicitly this way, it's a kind of thought experiment in which you take protagonists that the audience of white readers might identify with, but then you put them in an environment where they don't have New York City. They don't have, you know, subway systems. They don't have electric light. And then what happens? So I think it becomes a place for, especially for white readers, to play out for themselves, what would it be like to live in this other world? And would we still come out on top?
Mm. So Tarzan, basically, which you mentioned, which you discuss in the book,
is a
fairly pure example of that, isn't it? He's somebody who's the product of European, or he's American in the book, isn't he? No, he's English. He's an English lord.
English, yeah.
He's in Lord Greystoke, isn't he? So he gets, he gets stripped of all of the accoutrements of modern civilization and still comes out on top. I want to talk about Rider Haggard, I suppose, as one of the key originators of what we now call adventure fiction. How important was he in that movement, and how did he use this idea in his early books?
He was hugely important. H. Rider Haggard had been I believe he was an official with the British, I think in South Africa, and then the Transvaal. He had been a kind of minor colonial assistant for a period of a year or two, and came back to England, and then used some of his experiences in Africa to kind of transition to the life of an adventure writer. And he was modeling, you know, he really wanted to make a living doing this, and he wanted stuff to be popular. And the model that he used was Treasure Island. He thought this was, and to some degree, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He saw this as a formula, but then he used that formula and he had started applying it to new locales like the interior of Africa. And his book is really his breakout book, King Solomon's Mines, tells the story of these adventurers, British adventurers, who are going to find someone who's gone missing and end up discovering a lost colony in the heart of South Africa, where and the story of this community connects with the biblical story of King Solomon, who supposedly had a huge cache of gold. And so this story, King Solomon's Mine, was a huge, huge blockbuster hit, and really kind of set the ball rolling on lost tribe literature, both for Haggard, who wrote about it in sequel novels, as well as in other novels that kind of followed the theme, like She, which also became a very, you know, popular book.
What was the effect of like biblical thinking on this idea, and what did it provide for people's interpretation of ethnicity and history in a biblical sense?
Yeah, it's the biblical links to the story are really complicated, but to boil it all down, the story of Genesis, which is common to Jewish, Christian, and Muslim religious traditions, in Genesis 9, you had the story of the flood, Noah. Noah is essentially told by God that God is going to destroy the world and recreate it, and Noah is going to be humanity 2.0 with his sons and his sons' families. And so they gather on the ark, and for 40 days they're on this ocean, and then when the waters begin to clear, the ark comes to rest on Mount Ararat. People from these traditions pretty much know that story. What's less commonly known now is that when Noah and his sons and his sons' families disembark on Mount Ararat, they start farming. Noah has a garden of sorts, growing grapes, and whether intentionally or unintentionally, Noah eats these fermented grapes and gets drunk, and that he is found by his son Ham. And Ham reports that his father is naked and passed out to his other brothers, his other two brothers. And Japheth and Sem, and that these two other brothers go and cover their father. And when the father wakes up, he curses Ham. And it's a little unclear from the reading exactly what the sin is here, what the problem is. Was it that Ham had seen his father naked and not looked away? Was it because of something that had been written out of the story from an earlier date? We're not really sure. But what's important for the telling is that Noah curses Ham. And in fact, he doesn't actually curse Ham. What he does is he's angry at Ham and curses Ham's son Canaan to be forever a slave of his brothers. And that story of the curse of Ham, which was kind of passed down to Ham's descendants, was used throughout history to explain a bunch of different things. The first of which is being that if you grew up believing in one of these traditions, you believed that all of the peoples of the earth really descended from Noah and his three sons and their families. So you can go back to the Middle Ages and see all kinds of maps of the world in which various family members are kind of placed on various continents. Sem, which is the origin of the word Semitic, was frequently placed in Asia and the Near East. Japheth was placed in Europe, and Ham was frequently placed on the continent of Africa. And as we move into the Middle Ages, and especially after the 1400s, when the slave trade begins, you start seeing Europeans interpreting the curse of Ham as being the curse of race, that, oh, here we have a biblical explanation for why Africans are dark-skinned. This is a part of their biblical curse. Later, as the slave trade gets moving, people use this to justify slavery. They look to Genesis 9 and say, you see right here in the Bible, Africans who are the descendants of Ham were cursed with slavery. So it's not on us. This was actually, right from the Bible. So the curse of Ham gets attached to that. There's a complicated kind of flip which happens, which is in the 19th century, this curse of Ham, which seems to be cursing Black Africans, gets flipped, and Ham becomes a kind of white. White migrant from this biblical story. He becomes known as the father of a kind of a prehistoric white migration into Africa. That happens in the 1840s and 1850s. So by the time you get to the late 19th century, Ham has gone from being someone cursed in the Bible to being a kind of white progenitor of groups that were traveling through Africa.
Yeah, and I think in the book you talk about how some European explorers, when they were imparting ideas about Christianity to African kings or nobles, and how the African leaders would sometimes, they would take this idea to big themselves up, give themselves a connection to biblical history, something they could be proud of.
Yeah, there were explorers such as John Speke, who arrived in East Africa before Stanley and actually met Mutesa, and described for Mutesa the story of Ham. There were also on the east coast of Africa a number of Arab traders who already knew the stories of the of Noah and the Old Testament, and had also kind of relayed some of this to African kingdoms. So yeah, there was already a kind of swirl of information about kind of an early migration, either biblical migration or racial migration out of the Middle East into Africa at some point in the far past. And this actually kind of mingled together with some local mythology about origins. So King Mutesa and other East African groups had within their own belief system frequently talked about a group of people called the Bakwezi, and the Bakwezi were supposed to be somewhat light-skinned, semi-supernatural people from at least from northern Africa or the Nile region. So these different stories, African and biblical, become kind of mingled together.
So a little later in the timeline, by the 1910s and 20s, people are reporting lost white tribes in a wide variety of places. And I want to mention a couple of interesting characters who came up with stories from Panama. One of whom was a fellow called Marsh, and the other was a writer I know from, you know, science fiction pulps and the creator of a lot of lost race fiction, himself, Hyatt Verrill. So they both had stories about Panama, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, there had been reports from very early on. I can't remember whether it's from the Portuguese or not, but there was some talk in the 15 and 1600s about white Indians living in the isthmus. Richard Marsh is an American who, in the years after World War I, is sent to Panama to find areas where rubber plantations might be cultivated. This was a period of time when the United States thought it was actually important to its national security to have a good supply of rubber in case the, you know, war came again. So Marsh was there on a kind of a commercial expedition. And while he's traveling around in Panama among the Kuna Indians, he notices that some of them are quite light skinned and have blonde hair. And he asks about them and he gets a variety of kind of reports of who they might be. He eventually actually takes a couple of them back to the United States. They tour the Smithsonian. They meet various people. And for Marsh, Marsh uses this as an opportunity to talk about, well, where would white people have come from in the heart of Panama? Are these the descendants of conquistadors who had kind of gone native, or does this align with even earlier traditions among the Aztec and the Inca, who sometimes talk about royalty as having light skinned, or some earlier migration? So that also gets picked up, yeah, and people run with it.
Yeah, am I right in saying that Hyatt Verrill had a similar? I think he wrote. He wrote a lot of travel books as well as science fiction, and he had a story about seeing, you know, a white-skinned person in a Panamanian village and following, you know, the instructions of locals to get to a place where he thought there was an entire village of these people. I must track that one down.
Yes, yeah, he did, and I'm blanking on the Alphys Hyatt Verrill, I think, right? Yeah, yes. And he had, what did he write about? A book called From Brazil to Mexico?
Yeah,
blanking on the title.
Very interesting guy, and yeah, like he lived, you know, a certain amount of adventure fiction, and he wrote, you know, outright fiction as well. I might move us forward.
Actually, you know, the book that, sorry, I was just looking it up in my book. He wrote an essay, I believe, called Hunting the White Indians.
Yes, in the 1940s, this idea, and you talk about this in the book too, is brought to kind of a slightly sinister climax of sorts. With a German by the name of Ernst Schaefer, and this famous 1938 Nazi Tibet expedition. How did the ideas about lost race feed into that?
So with the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany in 1933, this idea of a kind of Aryan homeland became particularly interesting to Nazi officials, especially Heinrich Himmler, who was the director of the SS. And the SS had its own research arm, the Annenerbe. And so you had a couple of things going on at one point in the, you know, at one level, the Nazi Party was interested in some of the geographical feats that it saw other countries attempting, in particular, the British with mountaineering in the 1920s were beginning attempts on Mount Everest and other Himalayan 8,000 meter peaks. So some of these efforts were put into mountaineering, climbing Nanga Parbat in the Himalayas. And but also there was this kind of interest in finding the racial homeland of the Aryan people. The swastika, of course, was a symbol that came from India. It was connected to this idea that at some point in the past, the cultures of the world, the Indo-European cultures of the world, had actually been a racial culture that had dominated and conquered Europe and the Middle East. And so, you know, this was kind of cherry picking various pieces of information from linguistics and various reports. But the long and the short of it was that in 1938, there was an expedition funded by the Ananarbe to potentially find the homeland, the original homeland of the Aryan people. And that, so you had an expedition of Germans that went into the Himalayas to try to find people, along with all of the kind of anthropological measurements you might expect from a Nazi expedition to find a pure Aryan race.
And this is where we get some of the famous imagery of the, you know, measuring elements of people's faces using, you know, 1930s race science and these kind of scary looking implements to profile people in ways.
Yeah, and you even see you even see references to it in the Indiana Jones movie.
Yes, yes, of course.
With the Nazis and the Nazi fascination with the Himalayas.
Yeah. Well, Michael, in order to wrap up, towards the end of the book, you kind of circle back to the story of Henry Morton Stanley, and you're kind of wondering as to what did he really see, and probably one of those things that will never be known for sure. But you yourself went to visit some of the places where he had been traveling in Africa, and I just thought I'd ask, like, did you get any feeling for, you know, or did you get any insights from being there and seeing some of these places as to what it might have been like for him being there, and
yeah,
did that color his expectations or his interpretations of things that he saw?
Yeah. So the first thing I should say is that, you know, there were so many reports of white tribes, and as we've tried to chase these down, they all kind of disappear before our eyes. I mean, the white Indians, so-called, of Panama, there's very good evidence that this is a form of albinism among certain members of the Kuna tribe. That's been well documented. The blonde Eskimos that Stephenson describes, people have studied the copper Inuit of Banks Island, and there's no evidence of any of the, you know, intermixing of lost white explorers with local Inuit communities. The kind of differences that people see probably have to do with the fact that some of the people from Banks Island are of maybe an earlier migration, the slightly different as a population from later Inuit migrations into North America. So over and over again, we see like that these reports kind of disappear before our eyes in terms of a, you know, real link, let's say, which leaves us with the question of Stanley. So what did Stanley see, you know, when he saw these light-skinned people from Gambaragara? This is what I think we should remember about Africa as a place. Africa is the most diverse, in terms of human populations, it's the most diverse region on the planet. I mean, Our origin as a species is East Africa. Human beings have been living in modern human beings have been living in Africa for 200,000 years. A small group of those people migrated to other parts of the world somewhere around 70,000 years ago. But within Africa itself, there's an enormous amount of genetic variation and an enormous amount of just physical difference. And so I think that it was quite easy to imagine that explorers going to a region that they don't know and expecting to see people who are homogeneously one color or one have a one set of features are quite surprised when they see that, you know, the people in local regions in Kenya look incredibly different from those who live in Uganda or who live in the Congo. So I think that what Stanley was seeing was physical difference that he was associating with race. We also know that there are certain groups that live underneath the canopy of the Congo rainforest that actually did have lighter skin than other groups. But the part that you were talking about, my own travel to Africa in 2012 to finish research on this book, I actually tried to retrace Stanley's steps and even climb the mountain that he was unable to climb. And while I was there, one of the things I noticed about my experience just of being, in the western part of Uganda, where, you know, I had vaccinations, I had people were, I had a guide, I had a porter. I mean, I was not struggling in the same sense that Stanley or other explorers were struggling with malaria or other issues. I was pretty safe, mostly. But it was incredibly isolating for me. I was far, far away from my family, and for about 8 days climbing this mountain, it was really quite a physical ordeal, and I was very lonely, and I felt very out of my element, and I was imagining what it would be like to be Stanley, who was really 3 years out of contact with the West. Watching members of his own expedition die, and feeling enormously lonely, and even describing in his writings about how he had begun to see his African companions as people that he knew. He said, you know, there's a guy here, he reminds me so much of Thomas Jefferson, and other people who he described as, you know, being African, but just looking so much like another person. And I think when I was thinking about that, I thought, wow, you know, to be in a place where you don't really understand what's going on. You don't really understand the people you're surrounded by, but you're desperate to find links, desperate to find connection. And I was thinking it might be very much the case that some of these explorers were eager to see traits that they associated with people back home, maybe even so far as to say, maybe they have a connection to people I know. Maybe they have a connection with the European people I know. And especially if you had a myth structure that was there to kind of foster that idea, it wouldn't take a lot to, you know, to connect the dots in a way to say, yeah, I bet they probably have ancestral European blood. You know, maybe they're intermixed with Africans, but this is clearly a sign of European influence. So that was kind of a set of speculations I make at the end of the book.
Yeah, I do know what it's like when you're traveling and you're somewhere that's just so utterly different that it can be overwhelming sometimes. You get culturally overwhelmed sometimes. I have a book. I read a book somewhere about might have been Stanley, but is it on his later expedition when he pushes all the way through to the West Coast? And by the time he got there, there was a small port with some Europeans, and you know, having not seen any for 2 years or 3 years, whatever it was, you know, they appeared strange and alien to him, and you know, it's like he was seeing them for the first time or seeing them through outsider's eyes.
That's right. Yeah, I think it was in Boma, and it was actually the end of that same expedition where he had finally basically crossed the entire African continent from west to east and saw people. In fact, I have a short excerpt of it in my book. I can read it here if you want. He says,
"Yes, please."
as I looked, so this is actually, he met Boma's European residents. He says, as I looked into their faces, I blushed to find I was wondering at their paleness, the pale color, after so long gazing on rich black and richer bronze, had something of an unaccountable ghastliness. I did not dare to place myself upon an equality with them as yet. The calm blue and gray eyes rather awed me, and the immaculate purity of their clothes dazzled me. I was content to suppose myself a kind of connecting link between the white and the African.
Yeah, fascinating. So we might leave it at that. Is there anything else that we are, is there anything we haven't mentioned about the book that you think is worth saying?
Well, the one thing I would say is I think that frequently when we think about race science and the horrors of race science, we think about Nazi Germany. I think for those who follow the subject a little bit more deeply, we think about 19th century Europe and North America, where racial typologies were, you know, being used to segregate various groups or think about them in racial hierarchies. But I think the most important point of this book is that this racial thinking was not limited to Europeans thinking about people in their midst. It was a set of ideas that Europeans brought with them around the world and used to type people all over the world. And frequently that these ideas had a life of their own, even after Europeans left, even after decolonization began. And most devastatingly, you see that in the story of Rwanda, where you had two groups of people, the Bahutu and the Batutsi, who, because of colonial influence, began to see themselves as having distinct racial identities, and that they kind of, the Batutsi, adopted many of the ideas of a kind of origin, a white or proto-European origin outside of Africa, and that when the ethnic tensions between these groups grew after decolonization, this story that Stanley and others have talked about, a kind of white migration into Africa, had horrific consequences. It had basically allowed one group of people to say, you know what, you're not really African, you're not really one of us. And it made the genocide that occurred there all the more easy to perform. So there are real world consequences to these kinds of racial stories that have nothing to do with, you know, what happened in Germany in the 1930s, but that has a, that continues to have a life, you know, in parts of the world.
The Nazi stuff tends to take over in people's imaginations and in memories, and it's there's far more recent examples of it out there.
Yeah.
Michael, is there anything online you've got or another project that you'd like people to check out? And we'll put links in the notes.
I do have an essay coming out with Bloomfield Press. It's actually part of an edited collection about the history of exploration. I can get you a title for it. It's still in press right now. It probably won't come out until the fall. But the piece that I wrote on it is called The Explored and Their Explorations. And it's really about indigenous explorers in the 20th century. And it attempts to also, I think, try to reframe exploration as something that is, you know, seen as kind of like such a Western activity, and find ways of thinking about, well, what does it look like if we're talking about local peoples who are not Western? And
that sounds tremendous. So yeah, any details about that, I'll put links in, and then we can mention that when that comes out.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, very much appreciated. That was good. This book has really, you know, helped to shaped my thinking on the issue, and I know that this theme's going to come up again and again as I explore various elements of Lost World fiction and everything connected to it. So yeah, very big thanks to you, Michael.
Thank you.
That's the end of this evening's presentation. This has been the Lost Valley Podcast, and the Explorers Club is closing for the night. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so over at buymeacoffee.com/Lost Valley. You can also email at thelostvalley@mail.com. Take a drink for the road, and we look forward to seeing you at our next event. And remember, as Bernard Heuvelmans said, there are lost worlds everywhere.